Radio Reading Services of Greater Cincinnati presents The Science World. Welcome to The Science World, a half hour of news and commentary in science, technology, and medicine. On today's program, the science of gun violence, attack of the zombie baby monitors, and how are hurricanes named? I'm Steve Klaney. In the September-October issue of Discover, Russ Jaskalian investigates the science of gun violence. 39,773, how many Americans lost their lives to firearms in 2017? 1.625 million, the number of Americans who've died from gunfire since 1968, more than the accumulated American deaths from all wars since the country's founding more than 200 years ago. These are numbers that everyone agrees on. From here, nearly everything else that can be said about gun violence in the U.S. elicits a partisan response. It doesn't have to be this way. A growing chorus of researchers wants to study gun violence in the U.S. as a public health issue, similar to the way they've tracked automobile or workplace safety for decades. Though limited by largely political obstacles around funding, experts including epidemiologists, social scientists, and statisticians say that unbiased, peer-reviewed research is a missing piece of the gun violence discussion. Given the magnitude of the problem, not just in lives lost, but in the consequences for survivors, families, and entire communities, a purely scientific approach may hold the key to making progress toward reducing injuries and fatalities. There's one problem. Where to begin? We just don't know very much, says Andrew Morrell, a behavioral scientist who leads a RAND Corporation initiative called Gun Policy in America. We haven't been investing as a country in research in this area in the same way that we have in motor vehicle accidents, for instance, where for more than 35 years we've had an entire agency devoted to that, collecting fantastic data. The result has been that motor vehicle accidents are a quarter of what they were at the time the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration was started. A 2017 study estimates that for every death due to firearms, the U.S. spends about $63 on research into the topic. In contrast, research spending on motor vehicle deaths is about $1,000 per fatality. That disparity is particularly striking because the number of lives lost is similar. From 2008 to 2017, there were about 342,000 deaths by firearm and about 374,000 motor vehicle deaths. As former Congressman Jay Dickey wrote in 2012, the U.S. has spent about $240 million a year on traffic safety research, but there's been almost no publicly funded research on firearm injuries. The reason, ironically, has Dickey's name attached to it. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, the federal agency responsible for, among other things, researching and reducing injuries and violence, had long studied gun violence. But in 1996, Dickey submitted and helped pass the so-called Dickey Amendment, instructing that none of the funds made available for injury prevention and control at the CDC may be used to advocate or promote gun control. The language didn't ban research, it banned advocacy or promotion for gun control, says Garen Wintermute, a physician and public health researcher who leads the Violence Prevention Research Program at the University of California, Davis Medical Center. But everybody saw the writing on the wall, and CDC took itself out of the game, he says. A 2003 provision to a Department of Justice appropriations bill, called the Tired Amendment, dealt another blow. It prevented the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, or ATF, from releasing firearm tracing data, how illegal firearms flow from manufacture to sale to use. Prior to TIRED, such data had been invaluable to academic research, says Morrell. There was very useful scientific research going on, looking at how guns flow between U.S. states as a function of how permissive state laws are in terms of gun violence, says Morrell. The ATF also provided research on time to crime, or the length of time between a gun's purchase and its use in a crime. Such information could play a role in determining whether future policies achieve their desired results. The impact of both Dickey and Tyrant has been clear. From 1998 to 2012, the annual number of academic publications on gun violence dropped by 64%. There have been small windows of renewed public funding for research on gun violence, such as a 3-year period starting during the Obama administration that has since closed. And private donations, such as $2 million that the Kaiser Permanente Health Consortium committed in 2018 to studying the issue, have kept other initiatives afloat. But the limited, disjointed efforts are no substitute for a long-term, concerted focus by a government agency like the CDC in tackling a complex problem. What we do know about gun violence in the U.S. from a purely statistical perspective may surprise you. Mass shootings make headlines and dominate public discourse, but roughly 60% of firearm deaths in 2017 were suicides. That's 23,854 people who took their own lives with a gun. Most of them are older white men, says Bindu Kalasan, an epidemiologist and data scientist at Boston University's School of Medicine. In a 2018 study on suicide in the U.S. due to firearms, Kalasan found that the average American firearm suicide is a married white male over 50 with physical health issues. In a separate study, Kalasan discovered another demographic group taking the brunt of firearm-related loss of life expectancy, black men under age 20, who were dying from homicide. Because black male firearm homicides were much younger on average than white male suicides, the group's life expectancy saw the bigger reduction by more than 4 years. Women, meanwhile, make up around 10% of all U.S. gun deaths, and according to a study of 220 case histories, they're far more likely than men to be killed by an intimate partner. A 2014 review found some evidence that women with access to firearms are more likely to be victims of homicides than women without, possibly due to intimate partner violence. Overall, the rate of gun homicide is 25 times higher in the U.S. than in other high-income countries. For comparison, the rate of U.S. homicides due to causes other than firearms is only 2.7 times higher. And data from the FBI show that handguns are by far the most likely type of firearm to cause a fatality. In 2017, handguns were used in 7,032 of the 7,886 firearm-related homicide deaths where the type of weapon was known. The type of gun was not recorded in data on roughly 3,100 additional homicides. Perhaps most striking about the gaps in current gun violence data is how little we know about the shootings that don't result in death. If what you care about is state or national level gun deaths, homicides and suicides, we have good data, says Morrell. We don't have good data on firearm injuries, which represents the vast majority of firearm casualties. In fact, the CDC cautions that its own numbers on non-fatal firearm injury are unstable and potentially unreliable due to issues such as insufficient data. Even those imperfect numbers suggest an average of around 130,000 gun injuries per year. And the number of non-fatal gun injuries is merely one unknown in a complex web of gun violence fallout. Individuals and their families may experience physical, psychological, and financial repercussions, and so can a broader community. A neighborhood or city where gun violence is epidemic may also see lower property values, reduced tourism, and less community engagement, says David Hemenway, director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center. For the most part, we don't know the details because they haven't been studied. The key to tackling firearm violence, Hemenway and Pierce say, is taking a science-driven public health approach. The method, as laid out by the CDC, is straightforward. Define problems, identify risk and protective factors, develop and test prevention strategies, and assure their widespread adoption. Hemenway explains the public health model in simpler terms. Make it really hard to get sick and injured, and really easy to get healthy. There's already a long history of using the tools of public health research to reduce injury, perhaps most dramatically with car safety. Since the 1950s, the per-mile fatality rate in the U.S. has fallen by 80%. The reduction is rooted in myriad sources, such as increased seatbelt use, stricter penalties for drunken driving, and new regulations for licensing. But robust data collection, overseen by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, is particularly important. NHTSA tracks everything from vehicular accidents involving fatalities to recalls and crash test results, all down to the smallest detail. Researchers analyze this data to discover common patterns, while lawmakers use it to measure the effect of legislation. Graduated driver licensing, a multi-stage process for young drivers to become fully licensed, is a classic example. Researchers discovered that 16-year-olds had 10 times the risk of getting into a crash as older drivers. Those accidents happened most often at night and while driving unsupervised with other teens. So states implemented a simple solution. Initially restrict new licensed young drivers from driving at night or alone with their peers. By 1997, all 50 states had implemented some form of graduated licensing, and results were often dramatic. In Michigan, for example, the crash rate for 16-year-old drivers fell almost 30%. Such an impressive reduction in deaths, thanks to the public health approach, is not an outlier. For example, in the mid-1960s, more than 11,000 young children were poisoned by baby aspirin each year. Doctors, researchers, and drug manufacturers took a multidisciplinary public health approach, addressing drug flavoring and marketing, parent education, and dosing. The effort culminated in the Poison Prevention Packaging Act of 1970, when the U.S. mandated that medicine be sold in child-resistant packaging. Accidental baby aspirin poisonings of children younger than 5 dropped by an astonishing 70% 3 years after the change. And the public health approach can even save lives by analyzing data and identifying injury reductions that come about by happenstance. For instance, before England and Wales shifted utilities from domestic coal gas to natural gas in the 1960s and 70s, an economic decision that by chance eliminated deadly carbon monoxide, inhaling oven fumes was the method of choice for 41% of all suicides in 1963. After the switch, it became nearly impossible. The overall suicide rate in the two countries dropped by 30% and never rebounded. Preventing suicide was an unintended consequence revealed after the fact through public health data, but it showed what can happen when individuals contemplating the act lose an easy access method. Something similar may be possible when it comes to reducing gun violence. For instance, public health researchers agree that suicide is typically an impulsive act, often aborted before completion, and that the majority of people who survive an initial suicide attempt never make a second try. As shown in England and Wales, when an immediately accessible, highly effective means of suicide is no longer available, the overall suicide rate may drop. In the U.S., the limited data available suggests that only about 13% of all suicide attempts succeed. However, up to nearly 90% of attempts using firearms do result in death. The link between gun availability and suicide has already been studied in other countries. In the early 2000s, Swiss army reforms halved the number of soldiers, which also reduced the number of firearms kept in homes. Before the reduction, the suicide rate among 18 to 43-year-old men had already been falling. But researchers observed the rate dip sharply immediately after the reform and then continue its gradual downward trend. Around the same time, a similar phenomenon happened in Israel, which began requiring soldiers to leave guns on base during weekend leave. After the policy change, suicide among 18 to 21-year-old soldiers fell by 40% annually. The authors of a 2010 study on the policy's consequences observed that a reduction in weekend suicides, rather than during the week, was responsible for nearly the entire drop in deaths. While relatively minor reforms, such as those in Israel and Switzerland, can have significant impact on suicide prevention, the effects on policies on broader gun violence issues are often far more complex and difficult to assess. Morrell's team at RAND combed through the limited scientific literature on firearm policy in the U.S. to see which types of laws have the strongest evidence of reducing death and injury. Their analysis found that only child access prevention laws, such as those that require keeping guns at home safely locked, met their highest evidence-based standard for reducing injuries and deaths, and then only in children. The team found moderate evidence supporting the prohibition of gun ownership among people with mental illness or specific mental health histories. They also turned up moderate evidence that so-called stand-your-ground laws actually increased homicides. These types of laws vary by jurisdiction and can refer to a right to defend oneself, others, or property with lethal force rather than seeking safe retreat. Morrell warns that a lack of evidence doesn't necessarily mean a given policy is ineffective. In many cases, the research either hasn't been attempted or comes from small studies based in different states with disparate laws and other variables. For instance, there's moderate evidence that background checks, mostly those that occur at a dealership rather than private sales, reduce firearm suicides and homicides. But there's only limited evidence that they reduce overall suicide and homicide rates. It's unclear how many individuals use a different method to end their lives or someone else's if prevented from using a gun. There are also simply too few data to determine the effect of universal background checks, which would include all firearm transfers, not just those that occur at dealers. There are a whole lot of policy effects that haven't been studied, Morrell says, adding that many of the policies he and his colleagues looked at simply had no supporting research that met their standards for determining cause and effect. I really regard that as one of the big takeaways, he says. Among the most glaring gaps in current gun violence research, the reason people buy handguns today is to defend themselves, says Morrell, and we don't know what the facts are around that. For example, his team found evidence-based research in support of child access prevention laws saving children's lives. But Morrell says there have not been sufficient studies on how those same laws may affect other firearm-related issues, such as whether deaths increase or decrease when a child-proofed gun is involved in a legitimate act of self-defense. It's difficult to determine the full impact of such laws, positive or negative, when most of their consequences remain unknown. Another major issue, says Morrell, is that most available research is built on existing open-access databases compiled by government agencies such as the CDC. Researchers tapping into those data have no say over what information is collected or how. Instead of being able to design rigorous controlled studies, they typically have to dig through someone else's raw data, hoping to find correlations. Ambitious projects that cost money have been very, very difficult to do for the last 20 years, Morrell says. There have been exceptions. In January, the American Journal of Public Health published a study on gun violence in some of Philadelphia's high-crime neighborhoods. Researchers divided more than 100 geographic clusters of vacant, blighted lots into three randomly selected groups. Within each group, the vacant land received either light intervention, trash was collected in grass mowed, significant intervention, the lots were transformed into park-like settings with trees and new grass, or no intervention. The experiment lasted nearly 2 years, and researchers found a significant reduction in gun violence in the geographic clusters with vacant land that had been improved in some way. What's more, there was no evidence that shooting incidents moved from those improved clusters to adjacent areas. Another study underway in California will measure what happens when current firearm owners are later prohibited from possessing a firearm after, for example, committing a crime or receiving a specific mental health diagnosis. Researchers will be able to track outcomes in randomly assigned jurisdictions that give owners different amounts of time to surrender their guns. These are the sorts of studies that Morrell says have significant potential to help us better understand gun violence in America. It's a sentiment that Jay Dickey, who died in 2017, might have shared. As he neared the end of his life, Dickey advocated with increasing vehemence for a return to the very sort of research his 1996 amendment had halted. As he wrote in 2012, comparing gun research to the proverbial question about when to plant a tree, the best time to start was 20 years ago. The second best time is now. Next, Zombie Baby Monitors Attack by Zeynep Tufekci in the February Scientific American. Nowadays, many devices come with chips and are connected to the Internet, the so-called Internet of Things. The smart fridge that alerts you when milk is low or adds it to the shopping list, maybe even orders it from the grocery app. The air conditioner that anticipates when you want the house cooler for a run on the treadmill, but turns itself down when you're out at the movies. A baby monitor that tells you when it's time to stock up on teething gel. The little one has been tossing and turning a little too much. It sounds useful and wondrous. It's quite possible, however, that your internet-connected baby monitor instead spent last night teaming up with millions of other devices, cameras, printers, routers, speakers, air conditioners, DVRs, and more, to censor journalists, take down music, social media, or movie sites such as Twitter or Netflix, sabotage open-source software projects, knock almost a million German houses offline, or bring down cell phone communications in Liberia. With all this extra stealth activity, it's also running up your electricity bill. Wait, what? The problem is painfully simple and terribly thorny, and it is as much about globalization, law, and liability as it is about technology. Most of our gizmos rely on generic hardware, much of it produced in China, used in consumer products worldwide. To do their work, these devices run software and have user profiles that can be logged into to configure them. Unfortunately, a sizable number of manufacturers have chosen to allow simple and already widely known passwords like password, pass, 1234, admin, default, or guest to access the device. In a simple but devastating attack, someone put together a list of 61 such username-password combinations and wrote a program that scans the internet for products that use them. Once in, the software promptly installs itself and, in a devious twist, scans the device for other well-known malware and erases it so that it can be the sole parasite. The malicious program, dubbed Mirai, then chains millions of these vulnerable devices together into a botnet, a network of infected computers. When giant hordes of zombie baby monitors, printers, and cameras simultaneously ping their victim, the targeted site becomes overwhelmed and thus inaccessible unless it employs expensive protections. To make things worse, the authors of Mirai released the source code shortly after their debut censorship attack on the website of Brian Krebs, an internet security investigative journalist. Now, even people with rudimentary levels of coding skill can assemble their own giant zombie botnets. There are also peeping Tom sites that randomly scan for and easily find cameras with these simple known passwords and stream their feed to the world. What's the fix? You might have noticed that phones or laptops occasionally need software updates. These introduce new features, but they also often patch bugs and fix software vulnerabilities. Alas, most devices vulnerable to Mirai were also shipped with no feasible or easy way to update or fix them. I babysat various computer networks to pay for college, and the passwords that Mirai uses would be the same combinations I'd try when faced with a device with an unknown login. That this is still true so many years later points to the actual problem. Nobody's minding the store. Indeed, why bother? For manufacturers of chips or devices, there's often little to no downside to shoddy security. There's no authority with teeth and no clear law outlining liability from harm caused by such blatantly negligent security practices. The authors of Mirai appear to be U.S. college students who eventually pled guilty after being caught, but that's mostly irrelevant. As long as there are large numbers of devices with the admin/admin username-password combination, someone would have done this eventually. The bad news is that there's no real solution to Mirai except waiting for existing vulnerable devices to degrade. The good news is that if a few device makers who ship admin-admin gadgets were forced to pay hefty fines, or if parents of a hacked baby monitor could sue manufacturers or sellers, security would probably improve rapidly. The Internet of Things promises great wonders, but I'd like them to be less exciting. It's time to make baby monitors boring again and go back to worrying about the little one's teething rather than his or her security camera joining a zombie botnet and wreaking havoc across the globe. Finally, A Monster of a Name by Nathaniel Sharping in the July-August Discover. Remember Hurricane EP-022018? Of course not. While tropical depressions are struck with staid technical descriptors, it's a long-standing tradition to also give hurricanes human names. The rationale is that anthropomorphizing makes it easier for both scientists and the public to talk about major storms. But it wasn't always that way. Hurricanes were once named somewhat arbitrarily, sometimes after the saint's day on which they occurred, other times after geographical locations they hit. Then around World War II, meteorologists began informally assigning storms female names, and the U.S. began using an official list of feminine names for Atlantic hurricanes in 1953. The gender barrier was finally broken in 1979 when men's names were added to the list. Today, the list for the Atlantic consists of six rotating sets of 21 names maintained by the World Meteorological Organization. The first hurricane of the season gets a name beginning with the letter A, the second starts with B, and so on, with alternating female and male names. Different regions of the world have their own lists, so don't be surprised if you hear about a hurricane Sergio or Omeka. The lists won't ever change, though, except in the case of an especially destructive storm. Those names are retired out of respect. That's today's look into the science world. Our stories today came from the September, October, and July, August issues of Discover and the February Scientific American. The Science World is produced at the studios of Radio Reading Services of Greater Cincinnati. Questions or comments should be directed to Radio Reading Services of Greater Cincinnati, 2045 Gilbert Avenue, Cincinnati 45202. Join us next week when we'll again explore the science world. I'm Steve Pliny.